Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Catherine Shen. The Venice Biennale is the art world's most prestigious exhibition. It's sometimes even called the Olympics of Art, held annually in Italy. Right now, Pablo Delano, a Puerto Rico-born, Hartford-based artist, has an installation called The Museum of the Old Colony on its main stage. The installation includes photographs and artifacts that raise questions about America's relationship with Puerto Rico and its status as the world's oldest colony. The Museum of the Old Colony also raises questions about the institution of museums. And joining us now from Venice is Pablo Delano himself. He's a visual artist and photographer, as well as professor of fine arts at Trinity College. Thank you so much, Pablo, for being with us today.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And listeners, you can also join the conversation, 888-720-9677, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. So, Pablo, before we get to details about the show, can you give us an idea about your creative process and the mediums that you've chosen in terms of developing this idea for the museum project?
Sure. For many, you know, I'm trained as a painter. My entire education in art school was focused on painting. Then I turned to the medium of photography, published several books in photography, one on Hartford, as a matter of fact, one on Trinidad and Tobago. But around 2016, I felt a very powerful need to address certain historical happenings in my homeland of Puerto Rico. This was really provoked by the United States government imposition of a fiscal control board on the island in response to a debt that was deemed unpayable by the governor. That for me was just kind of a breaking point where I felt finally I have to address this in person and directly. And so then the question became how to go about that. And I turned to a collection that I had been acquiring over many, many years of historical photographs, artifacts, documents. And the question then became for me, how can I incorporate all that material into a work of art that was evocative and yet not preachy or didactic? Mm. That's sort of my challenge and my starting point.
And you know, how would you describe the Museum of the Old Colony? You know, as you shared with us, you previously worked mostly with photography. You have a background in painting. You know, why a museum in terms of the space, you know, this conceptual space of how to go about your project?
Well, I've always been fascinated with museums and the institution of the museum. As a kid, I loved going to museums and I admired them. And they always seemed to me to be a place of learning, a place of power. But as I got older, I realized that there's much more to it than that. I also visited museums of anthropology and history and really was taken with the potential that those institutions represented to teach, but also the way that they presented situations of power. So as I was developing this idea of how do I begin to grapple with all of this historical information and documents and objects that I've gathered, at the same time, I felt that it would be interesting to look at museums as not only a place where you can learn and where you can find enlightenment, if you will, but also as institutions that may have had a more of a complicit role in certain ways of seeing. So the idea of creating a kind of conceptual museum, or a museum that that was a play on the whole notion of the museum, really interested me. A lot of that came from, childhood experiences of visiting museums. And so the idea of what is the meaning of a gold frame around a work of art? You see a gold frame around a work of art, and immediately that tells you it's got to be good. Just walking into a museum, you assume that what you're going to see in there is true, it's beautiful, and I thought it would be important to begin to question that.
And so with your description, think about the gold frame, because I myself can picture a lot of those frames with my limited museum going experience, I think, comparatively. But like I would love to know, because so much of the show consists of photographs and artifacts, how did you go about collecting those items? Why go from photography to a mix of the mediums? And how do you think of these objects as art?
Actually, I don't think of the objects as art. I think of what I did with them as art.
Mm.
The objects and the photographs themselves, I had been informally collecting for a long time. There are a lot of ideas that go into this. For example, we're told from the time that we're very young that photographs don't lie, or more recently, post the picture or it didn't happen. So we have this investment in photography as a means of storytelling, but also as the assumption is that if the picture happened, if there's a picture of it, it's true. Of course, that's not true. Photographs are taken from a very specific point of view. And many decisions go into how we frame an image, how we frame a photograph. So one of the things that fascinated me was how we, people in Puerto Rico, were seen by the outsiders. In 1898, the United States government, the United States military, invaded Puerto Rico and took it as a territory. The Supreme Court of the United States defines Puerto Rico as belonging to, but not a part of, the United States. So that was the beginning of this very ambiguous and complex relationship. They sent photographers to create photographic images that would could be used in North America to popularize the idea that it was a good thing for the US to have an empire with colonies. So those photographs have a very particular point of view, and sometimes it's a horrific point of view where people are denigrated and infantilized and made to and portrayed as perhaps being worthy of receiving Uncle Sam's good intentions. Those are images that I felt needed to be seen, and then the question became, how do I do it in a way that's unique and personal and mine, rather than a preachy or historical exhibition?
Well, and you've talked about the photographs. Can you describe some of the photographs or objects or artifacts in this collection? I'm curious about some of the first pieces that you've collected. I'm sure we appreciate sort of an image of the first pieces that you've collected.
Well, the earliest photographs that were made in actually the year of the US invasion, 1898. Many of them were stereographs, which are three-dimensional photographs that require a viewer to actually see the 3D effect. But these were photographs that were very popular because there was no internet, there was no radio, there was no television. And one of the evening entertainments for people in the developed world, in Europe, in the US, so-called developed world, was to sit around and look at images through the stereo viewer. There are little cards, and I guess a more contemporary, more modern version might be the ViewMaster, where you hold it up and you see this illusion of 3D. So I began to collect those physically, but also from digital archives. Again, they're very problematic if we look at them today, in that they use they're very invested in racializing the people that they portray, and in promoting this idea that the US can save these so-called primitive, unsanitary people by doing things like imposing the English language.
And I want to do a little bit of a backtrack here because we're talking about your work, and it's called The Museum of the Old Colony. And we'd love for you to share, why the Old Colony?
Well, as part of this sort of search and struggle to define the project, I also wanted to include some degree of whimsy, although the project itself and the work itself is very serious and includes a lot of imagery that could be hurtful and shocking. At the same time, as a child, I grew up drinking, and we all did, a soda. A soda that was originally imported from the US and is now to this day manufactured in Puerto Rico. And the name of that soda is Old Colony. The logo of it is a US Minuteman, Revolutionary War soldier. It is full of sugar in a country that has a terribly high rate of diabetes. It is artificially flavored with grape, which is a fruit that doesn't even grow in Puerto Rico, and yet it remains to this day a very popular drink. So I found it very ironic and funny, but also very sad that this is still to this day a very popular soft drink, and it's called Old Colony Soda. So that sort of began to be a way for me to lead into developing the project, which was at one time consciousness raising, but at the same time sort of had a whimsical or humorous side to it that played up on the irony of our situation.
And it's interesting, learning about that and sort of experiencing that irony, because you mentioned the title of the show is a little ironic, is a little tongue in cheek, is a little whimsy. And among the seriousness, of course, with this project, are there what sorts of questions do you hope to inspire, not just about colonialism, but also the roles and responsibilities of museums today?
Well, we make assumptions about museums, but many people who visit museums take a lot of things for granted. And I think that's a mistake. I think we need to question everything in museums, from the way things are displayed to the text on the wall labels. And in terms of my project, I'm hoping that by adapting the idea of this sort of conceptual museum or performative museum where I get to play in a sort of carnivalesque way all the roles of that you would find for people involved in museums. So I'm the play curator, I'm the designer, I'm the executive director, I'm the chairman of the board, whatever. Overall, I'm hoping that the premise of the museum and having a museum within a museum or within an institution that's museum-like will provoke people to ask about what roles museums can actually play and whether the assumptions that we have made about museums are accurate and whether they need to be questioned. And beyond that, what is our complicity in buttressing and supporting this idea of what the museum is?
You've been listening to Pablo Deano, who's a visual artist and photographer, who will be staying with us to continue this conversation. And listeners, you can also join in. Give us a call, 888-720-9677. That's 888-720-WNPR, or leave us a comment on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. ECMO is a leading-edge, life-saving treatment for patients with cardiac or respiratory failure. Dr. Jason Gluck, director of the Mechanical Circulatory Support Program and Emergency Cardiac Care at Hartford Hospital, explains what it is.
So ECMO stands for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, outside the body oxygenation of blood. It's a life support technique that's used by highly sophisticated medical systems for patients with severe heart or lung failure. The technique involves removing blood from the body, oxygenating it, and then returning it back.
ECMO procedures happen in the ICU, but not all hospitals are equipped with the necessary technology and staff. Dr. Gluck describes Hartford Hospital's ECMO Go team.
So ECMO is considered when treatments have failed. And in our center, with a special ECMO on the Go team, we'll actually take that technology to their hospital and help them out there if they need to stabilize the patient and then bring them back to Hartford for recovery.
For more information, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Catherine Shen. This hour, we're heading to the Venice Biennale, which is a massive event sometimes called the Olympics of Art. And back with me to help us run through that Olympic of Art is Pablo Delano, who is a visual artist and photographer, as well as a professor of fine arts at Trinity College. His installation is called The Museum of the Old Colony and is taking the main stage at this year's event. So, Pablo, earlier we were talking a little bit about sort of the genesis of the Museum of the Old Colony. Can you talk about that process to Venice, you know, and why the museum is being a focal point at the Biennale is so significant?
Sure. I want to pick up a little bit with where we left off in terms of just giving a broad description of what you see. You walk into a room where you see hundreds of photographs that have been enlarged. In addition to the objects and the video pieces in the show, none of the original historical materials are included. And I did that on purpose because I didn't want people to invest in the objects as collectibles or valuables, or valuable items. I wanted the power of the image, itself, to speak for as an image rather than as an object that had any kind of inherent value. So all of the photographs are reproductions, large-scale reproductions. In terms of the trajectory, this is about the 10th iteration of the project. It started in a very small space, actually in Trinidad, many, many years ago, and it's been in various museums. The way that this actually happened was that an earlier version of the project is in the permanent collection of the Museum of Contemporary Art in San Juan. And that is where Adriano Pedrosa, the curator of this year's exhibition at the Venice Biennale called Foreigners Everywhere, saw the work and reached out to me, and that led to discussions. And so he ended up inviting me to be a part of this.
And so there's a theme for the Biennale this year. It's Foreigners Everywhere. So how did that inform how you want to adapt the collection for this venue and for the audience?
It's interesting that you ask that, because when the theme was announced, I got very excited. Mm-hmm. I was already involved in negotiations with Adriano Pedrosa. He had reached out to me. We had had several conversations, but I had not yet been formally invited. So when the theme was announced, I thought, this is an amazing theme, and it fits so well with what I'm doing, because Puerto Ricans are in a sense, the professional foreigners everywhere. Why? Because Puerto Rico is neither a country nor an independent state. We have a U.S. passport, and yet we have an Olympic, and we have a U.S. passport. We have an Olympic, but we have an Olympic team, which nations have. States can't have an Olympic team. New York State, Connecticut can have its own Olympic team, but Puerto Rico has an Olympic team. Puerto Rico competes in Miss Universe contests as a nation, but yet it's not a nation. So it's a very, very complex idea of nationhood. You hear constantly in the media about Puerto Ricans who have been denied access to a certain thing, even like a rental car, because the person at the rental car company wanted to see their passport, not knowing that Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens. I wrote to Adriano Pedrosa at that point, and I said, Adriano, I don't know if you're still considering me. We've had several conversations, but I love the theme. After all, you know, whether or not you pick me, I hope Puerto Rico gets represented in your show, Foreigners Everywhere, one way or another, because we are the professional foreigners everywhere. And very soon after that, I received the formal invitation.
Well, sounds a little kismet there that this was happening. And I can't imagine being able to sort of turn that into reality and to have so many, you know, people being able to witness what's happening at the Biennale. So what has it been like for you to watch people take it in? You know, we'd love to hear about some of your experiences in that space.
Well, it's really been extraordinary. And one of the things I've been lucky enough to do is spend some time here after the exhibition opens. I've seen parents explaining the exhibition to their kids. The audience, of course, is quite international. I've seen gasps with people just can't believe that these images are true and taken out of historical sources. One of the components of the exhibit is a QR code, which lets you through, because each item is numbered in the exhibit, it lets you see the actual source. You can actually trace back to which book or which image comes exactly from where, what press agency, who the photographer was. So all of these images are appropriated from these historical sources, but the historical sources are available to the viewer to see where each thing came from. I've had amazing conversations just by chance with people who I've noticed have been very taken. So I've just gone up to them and introduced myself. And for instance, I had an extraordinary conversation with two South African women who told me that they could completely relate to everything that what the exhibit was grappling with, even though it was a completely different country in a different part of the world. I've seen, as I think I mentioned, there are two video pieces as well. So there's video, there's objects, three-dimensional objects, and there's photographs. I could barely contain myself from laughing when I noticed that one of the videos has several clips of Trump and his response after Hurricane Maria, defending the FEMA response, which was dismal. I watched as this wonderful older Italian woman sat there and actually gave him the finger to the screen.
And you didn't laugh out loud.
I tried to be incognito.
Well, well done.
So it's been really fascinating to watch people as they go through the show. What? And it's very crowded. It's very crowded.
Well, I'm constantly amazed at what technology can do. Just you mentioned the QR code. It didn't even occur to me that that's another way of people, they can use it as another tool to learn about your pieces and the history and all of that. And also just a quick note for our listeners that you can see the images of this installation on our website as well at ctpublic.org/where we live. And earlier you shared with us that this is the 10th iteration of the project, you know, started in Trinidad. And can you tell us more about how you adapted the collection for the Venice Biennale? You know, are there specific adjustments you made for this particular venue?
Yes, I make specific adjustments for every venue, and they're in two ways. I have to consider the physical space itself, which is different in every venue, but then also I consider the cultural context of each location. In terms of physical space, working here at the Biennale was a dream, because I was given this enormous gallery at the center of the central pavilion. And basically that was offered to me as a kind of blank canvas. It was an empty room and I needed some walls built. So they built the walls, they painted it the colors I wanted. The lighting designer designed specific lighting to work with the space, with my design that I presented. But more interesting perhaps is the cultural adaptation. So Venice, you wouldn't think about it really, but Venice and Puerto Rico have some things in common. The most obvious may be the sea. They're surrounded by the sea and they have a great dependence on the sea. So that's reflected in some of the images that I chose, which focus on the U.S. Navy presence in Puerto Rico and the sailors and how they interacted with people in Puerto Rico, which was not always the most pleasant kind of way. Other other sort of connections have to do with tourism. Puerto Rico is very dependent on tourism for economic gain, and the same is true in Venice. But tourism brings with it a whole series of problems, such as the displacement of people who have lived in their homes for a very long time and find they can no longer do so because there's such a demand for short-term rentals that people are forced to either evicted so the owners can turn the apartment into short-term rentals, or they're actually the property owners who sell to others who are going to create short-term rentals. Those are some of the ways in which I address. Then there's the migrant situation in Italy, where you have migrants coming over and crossing the Mediterranean in makeshift boats. We have the same situation in Puerto Rico with people coming from Haiti and the Dominican Republic in makeshift boats. So all of these things are referenced specifically in the referencing Puerto Rico, but obviously in a way that I think will reflect on Venice as well, or will suggest that these things are also happening in Venice.
Well, I mean, even with what you described, it seems like it's you take out the country and you replace it with a different country. There's a lot of universality to it, especially you sharing with us the conversation you had with the two South African ladies who really felt the pieces resonated with them. And now there's all these parallels between Puerto Rico and Venice. Is that something that surprised you or surprised the audience? Is that something that you top of mind, maybe?
Well, this is something that I try to do wherever I do the project. So, for example, when the project was previously in Virginia, the capital of the Confederacy, I chose to include many, many images that dealt with the question of race, because these images that were created in the early years of the U.S. occupation are very much racialized. The photographers and writers who described Puerto Rico that they saw seemed to be unable to avoid racializing and making references to the color of people, and often in very denigrating ways. So it wasn't really surprising. I don't know the degree to which people really make the connections, but I suspect they do here in Venice with the greater Venice situation, especially the tourism. Because Venice is overrun by tourists.
And I think sort of related to tourists as well, because I'm also thinking about the audience that's unique to this event. It's very prestigious and very pricey. So you've also made one adjustment to sort of address the elites in the crowd, if you will. Can you talk to us about that?
I think I know what you're talking about. Well, there's one new section that I haven't included in previous iterations that deal with the elites in Puerto Rico and suggests their complicity with the colonizer and their way that they have dealt with questions of race. And, you know, there's a myth that there's no racism in Puerto Rico. It's a myth that was promoted by the government and many others during the mid-20th century and even to this day. And that's also sort of baked into this grouping of images of the elites and upper classes.
Gotcha. Right. And so that's one. Is that unique to this particular event, or is that something that you've worked with before?
The grouping as such is unique to the Venice Biennale, but the images I've used some of the images in the past in other sections. So the installation itself is presented in a kind of set of groupings, thematic groupings, so that there may be, I forget, 8 or 10 thematic groupings, each of them consisting of a series of images and objects that address a particular issue, such as women's issues. Mm-hmm. There's one section that deals with the oppression of women in the mid-20th century in Puerto Rico. Two specific things happened: the forced sterilization of many, many, many women, and the use of women as guinea pigs in birth control experiments. Experiments for the when the birth control pill was first invented, they needed human subjects to test it on, and those human subjects were Puerto Rican women. And of course, they didn't know what the proper dosage was for these pills. So initially, they gave much too high dosages. And there's a whole legacy of a whole generation of women who participated in these experiments and got very bad cancers. So that's all highlighted in one section. Then there's the tourism section and other sections that we've already mentioned.
Well, and very much building on what you just shared is the reviews we've seen so far has been very positive. And a writer from Art News has also said, how can you not read the Delano installation as a denunciation of the U.S. and its exploitation of Puerto Rico, often called the world's oldest colony? It's a work that requires you to spend time with it to see how all that has been collected here speaks to what the U.S. has used to its benefit. I think that especially potent right now as discussions around self-determination and settler colonizations are being applied to Israel and Palestine. And so I think this also reflects with what we've been speaking about, really this whole conversation, Pablo, is this universality and how it resonates with many people across the world. So, you know, what are your thoughts with what this writer had to say?
Well, I was very happy to read what he wrote because he got it. He was one of the reviewers who really profoundly understood what this was about. And I was very happy to see. He's the only, there have been a lot of positive reviews and a few negative reviews, which I find very interesting. But he's the one who really focused on looking at this as a metaphor for things that are going on beyond Puerto Rico in the global context. So, you know, something that was certainly on my mind and people that I've spoken to here at the Biennale and other colleagues are well aware that this is, you know, sort of built in. In fact, in preparing this version of the exhibit, I made certain choices that were geared towards permitting the viewer to see that global context, such as replacing very specific things that might be only accessible to people who have a great deal of knowledge about Puerto Rico with other material that also referenced Puerto Rico, but also in a more general way.
Right. And with that experience too, I mean, I know we're scraping sort of the surface here, but have you been satisfied with the reception, you know, whether from the public or from critics? You know, how has that experience been like for you?
Well, I would say yes, very satisfied. It's been extraordinary. And as I told the curator, Adriano Pedrosa, for me, it's an enormous honor to have been selected and to have this great opportunity, but it's also a huge responsibility, I feel, because it is not an easy subject matter, despite the whimsy and the humor we talked about earlier. It's very serious. It represents 500 years of colonial oppression of a people who have never had true self-rule since the first European stepped foot on the island in 1493. That was Christopher Columbus. Mm-hmm. So commissioned or to be invited to present this installation, knowing that it was a representation of 500 years of colonial trauma, is a huge responsibility. It's daunting. And I only hope that I've been able to live up to it. From the reactions, I think I might have had some success, but time will tell. And looking forward to hearing more what other writers and critics have to say.
Well, and as these conversations continue and as we learn more and explore more, you know, any final thoughts that you would like to share with our listeners? What do you hope they can take away from this conversation today?
Well, I hope that there would be, that it will spike more interest in Puerto Rico and beginning to sort of understand or try to begin to understand this complex place, which has a unique status. It's in the world, which is that it's a nation, but it's not allowed to be a nation. It's neither a state of the U.S. nor an independent country. It's also facing what I would consider a very difficult challenge in the year ahead with the in trying to respond to this fiscal control board that was imposed by Washington to deal with what I would consider an odious debt or an illegitimate debt, because it was a debt that was acquired under coercive or oppressive situations. And so what will happen to the island remains to be seen, and it's very hard to be optimistic when there seems to be more and more interest in repaying this debt at any cost. So austerity measures have been imposed, severe budget cuts, privatization of utility companies have made the situation virtually impossible for people to live, and the choice is to migrate and to leave and come to the U.S. mainland, which is very easy because we're U.S. citizens.
And so, well, thank you so much for sharing that, Pablo. Before we go to break, I do want to take one quick call from Fiona, who's calling from us at the University of Connecticut. Fiona, you have about 30 seconds here. You're on air.
Hi, Pablo. Congratulations. I'm sorry I couldn't hide in your suitcase to come with you. I wanted to ask you, what are some of the possibilities about the afterlife of this installation, given that there's been about 10 of them? And I was wondering about storage and preservation, and also whether there might be the possibility of a permanent Connecticut installation of it. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Fiona, for calling in. Pablo, Fiona, asking about...
Thank you. Yeah. Yes, thank you, Fiona. Great to hear your voice. The exhibition is inherently ephemeral, and I would not want to create a permanent installation of it anywhere, because the physical aspect of the the physical aspect is not the point. The point is the content. In fact, going back to our first version ever in Trinidad, I created that with the idea that the prints would just be torn up and destroyed. Having said that, the opportunity to present it here in Venice has opened up what I hope will be many possibilities. I've had the opportunity to meet really wonderful people that I have looked up to for many years in the art world, who were very, very taken and were effusive about how powerful they felt the project was, and have committed to me, at least informally, verbally, to promote the project and bring it to major museums throughout the United States, at least. So I think this will increase the visibility of the project. And I have Adriano Pedrosa to thank for that and his vision and understanding, because he felt it was important to bring it here.
Well, we thank you, Fiona, for calling in with that amazing question and sharing sentiments that we also wish we can pop into a suitcase and join you there in Venice, Pablo. You've been listening to Pablo Delano, who's a visual artist and photographer. Thank you so much, Pablo, for sharing your experience with us today.
Thank you so much.
And coming up next, we'll hear from Faisal Saleh, who's the founder of Palestine Museum US in Woodbridge. He organized his own unofficial exhibition in Venice called Foreigners in Their Homeland. You can also join the conversation, 888-720-9677, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Catherine Shin. This hour, we've been taking a tour through the Venice Biennale. Palestine Museum US in Woodbridge was not selected for this year's events, but it is showcasing an exhibition in Venice, beyond the bounds of the Biennale, called Foreigners in Their Homeland. It features 27 artists. And joining us now to discuss is Faisal Saleh, who's the founder and executive director for the Palestine Museum US in Woodbridge here in Connecticut. Thank you so much, Faisal, for being with us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And so you recently got, we were having you back in Connecticut as you visited Venice recently. You know, what was it like to see this show get set up and for it to be on view now?
Well, it was a very gratifying thing to have the ability to tell the Palestinian story to a global audience in Venice. as the museum's mission really is to tell the Palestinian story through the arts, this was an opportunity for us to fulfill our mission. And originally, the exhibit was designed and submitted to the Venice Biennale. That's why the name Foreigners in Their Homeland is very consistent with the declared theme of the Venice Biennale. We thought this was really a perfect fit because Palestinians in, under occupation feel like they're foreigners in their own land. And we wanted to explain that concept to people. Having the show all put together and having a great opening, which we had on the 20th of April in the exhibit hall itself, we had 150 people present. The exhibit hall is 150 square meters, so it's one of the largest exhibitions and in the building we happen to be in. I should also thank the people of the European Cultural Center, which is another organization that holds exhibits during the same time as the Biennale and has a few hundred exhibits of their own in multiple venues. We're in a venue called Palazzo Mora. We have like the largest exhibit in Palazzo Mora.
And can you tell us, you know, how did you adapt the event to that particular space? You know, what can you tell us more about the exhibit and how it was laid out?
Yeah, well, let's start just a little bit about the curation of the exhibit.
Sure.
You know, we always take in consideration the mission of the museum, what we're trying to do. So our mission was to tell the story of the Palestinians. And the story of the Palestinian has to do with the Nakba, the dispossession of the Palestinians in 1948 and 75 years thereafter, the occupation and living under the apartheid situation in the West Bank and the siege on Gaza, and more recently the genocide in Gaza. So these three things were important considerations as to how we wanted to approach the curation of the exhibit. And I'm actually the curator of the exhibit as well. And the challenge I had is how do you curate 75 years of dispossession, and how do you curate in a dynamic environment that was changing daily? I've looked at a lot of Palestinian artists all over the world, in Palestine and the diaspora, and selected a possible set of artists, and then we narrowed that down to 26 Palestinian artists. And we ended up adding another artist from Scotland because there was a donated piece to the exhibit that was so compelling, we included it. And normally we only feature Palestinian artists.
Can you tell us about that piece? Why was it so compelling?
It was compelling because the women of the Scotland Highlands, curated by Jane Ferrer, who's an artist from the area there, decided to create a memorial for some of the people who were killed in Gaza. And they selected 2,500 names. Jane Ferrer distributed the name among 85 people. And each one of them had to cut a piece of cloth and by hand write the name of somebody. And then they had to sew all these names on one giant Palestinian flag. Mm-hmm. And they rolled that and they shipped it to us in Venice. So that's really one of the highlights of the show. So the idea is we want visitors to come, and we want them to learn about Palestine and understand a lot of the things that have not been told in the past, because the mainstream media has not really done a good job talking about Palestine. And the time had come for people to understand what actually happened in Palestine and what is happening now. And that's what the exhibit really does.
Well, and I think another highlighted name is a Palestinian-American artist, Asamiah Halabi, who is globally renowned. one of the 27 artists who was included. And one of her pieces is also recognized in this year's Biennale. Can you tell us about her piece and why is her inclusion in an event like this so significant?
It is very significant in a number of ways. First of all, Samia Halabi is one of the top artists in the world, top abstract artists. She was also invited to participate in the Venice Biennale in the same event as Pablo, our prior guest, whom I really admire, and I love what he's doing. And I'm looking forward to meeting him when he comes back, hopefully. They've selected one of her works, and she also actually won an honorable mention award. She decided to provide a significant work that she painted specifically for our exhibit, and it was finished like about a month ago. It's a very large work. It's about 3.38 meters wide, and it's called Massacre of the Innocents in Gaza. It's a very bold meaning, very bold move. Samia is very strong about Palestinian rights, to the point where her exhibit at the Indiana University was canceled because of her positions on Palestine, and she would never compromise that. And her giving the exhibit this tremendous work is a great sign of her commitment to Palestine. And for us, it was a great honor to be able to exhibit Samia Halabi at this event that we're participating in.
Well, honestly, I've seen an image of that piece, and it truly is very powerful and compelling. And sadly, when we're having fun, we only have a couple minutes left. But we'd love to ask Faisal, do you have a favorite piece in this series and why?
I don't have just one favorite piece.
I have a lot of
a lot of favorite pieces. It's just like asking somebody, which one of your children do you like the most? I mean, I handpicked every piece in the exhibit, and they're all great. You know, we have a couple of portraits that I put them on the cover because I was so impressed by these portraits. There are animations. We have two computer animations that tell a Palestinian story. One of them in 5 minutes, you can learn the history of Palestine in 5 minutes. Incredible innovation and talent that's expressed there. I really couldn't begin to tell you which one. I suggest that everybody, when we have the exhibit books, take a look at the exhibit book if you visit the museum in the U.S. And for those people who are in Europe, in Venice, please go see the exhibit. It's at Palazzo Mora. And actually, if you guys can tell Pablo, he may not know about it, we would love to see him visit.
Well, Pablo, if you're listening, that is Faisal's note for you to visit the exhibition there. And we've got about 30 seconds left, but Faisal still would love to ask, you know, any final thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners?
No, I just would like to thank your organization here for giving us an opportunity. As you know, mainstream media is not very keen on giving Palestinians a voice. And you are like the bright the sunshine in an otherwise dull day.
Well, you're going to start my week by making me cry. So thank you very much, Faisal, for sharing that.
Well,
you've been listening to Faisal Saleh, who's the founder and executive director of the Palestine Museum U.S. in Woodbridge, Connecticut. Thank you so much for being with us today, Faisal.
Thank you.
I'm Catherine Shen. Today's show is produced by Katie Pellico. Our technical producer is Kat Pastor. Download Where We Live anytime on your favorite podcast app. And thank you so much for listening.